What is your killer strategy? The one that gives your business the ultimate bulletproof competitive advantage. Welcome to Your Advantage Play with your host, Joel Block. Former professional blackjack player and card counter who left Las Vegas and spent his life in that giant casino on Wall Street in the hedge fund and venture capital businesses. And now, here's your host, Joel Block.
The private equity world is a mystery to most people, but for executives in particular, how to connect with them might be the most important or valuable career move you can make. So how do you do it? To answer that question, Dave Bradford. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I appreciate you having me.
Hey, man. So you are the CEO of a private equity-backed roll-up, basically a company that's acquiring lots and lots of other companies and putting them in a package. Why don't you just kind of give us the lay of the land? Not everybody understands private equity. They don't understand roll-up. They don't understand some of the strategies necessarily that that these guys are executing. So why don't you just give us a little bit of the lay of the land about what you guys are doing and what your charge is?
Yeah. So, you know, private equity, in essence, to overly simplify it, what private equity does, like you and I might buy and trade stocks, either through our 401ks or IRAs or whatever. Private equity is essentially buy and trade businesses. So instead of buying a piece of a company like Apple, they'll buy a whole company. And the goal is the same. They're trying to create value or realize value in the appreciation of the value of whatever they bought, whether it's a single share, 100 shares, or the entire company. And there's a lot of different ways private equity goes about it. You know, some focus on, you know, most private equities will focus on a particular industry or a particular niche or a particular situation. It could be a growth strategy. It could be a turnaround strategy. It could be taking a business and professionalizing it, maybe making it more efficient or automation. But all of those things are different ways of enhancing and increasing the enterprise value of the overall investment. And so they'll go out and they're kind of, they'll put their focus and expertise out into the marketplace, and they'll raise money by having investors invest in them based on what their focus is going to be. And then their goal is to provide themselves and their investors a return on their investment through the enhancement of value. At Certus, the investment thesis was a buy and build strategy. Some people refer to it as roll-ups. Those are pretty interchangeable. And the idea is that within pest control, like a lot of the home services businesses, the what you pay or what the valuation is of a smaller company is a lower multiple, a lower valuation than bigger ones. Pest control is extremely fragmented. There's roughly 20,000 pest control companies in the United States. The two biggest are well-known names, Orkin and Terminix. But number 100 on the top 100 list is only $7 million in revenue. Yeah. And so you can imagine if number 100 is $7 million in revenue, there's another 19,000 plus that are less than $7 million in revenue. So it's extremely fragmented by a bunch of smaller companies. We often refer to them as mom and pops, local businesses, single owners. You can aggregate those and buy a bunch of those and put them together to build a single large asset, which trades at a higher multiple. And that's pretty much the investment thesis. High volume M&A, growing a business to create a larger asset, which is not common and highly coveted.
So let me ask some questions. I spent my life in this business, so it's something I understand very well. But how are you finding these 19,000 companies, and it seems like there would even be more. I mean, just because there's so many pest control companies in every city. But how are you finding these companies? And then how do you reach out to them and say, hey, you want to join our team? And it's going to be better for you if you do that. How does that work?
Well, I'll mention the first method, which is not the most preferred, but that's through brokers. So there are industry players and brokers that specialize in home services and or pest control. And those brokers provide a skill set and an expertise to help you present your company to potential buyers. Those brokers who've been doing it for a while generally know who the major players in the industry are who are buying up other businesses. So that's one avenue. We do that. It's not our preferred method. We have an internal business development team that we go out and create our own list of potential targets. We nurture market ourselves to those buyers by making impressions. Marketing, you know, impressions is a very marketing type term. And so there's some pest control owners that we've been talking to for years. You meet them at conferences, you build relationships. If and when they ever reach the point to where they want to monetize this business that they've built, you hope that you're the first one that they think of because of the relationship that you've cultivated over time. You can do that. How do you get insight? Pest control is governed by the State Department of Agriculture in each state. Pest control, you need a license. You need a certified operator. Maybe your technicians need to be licensed. And that information is public information. So you can go scrape those websites and get visibility into the operators in a given state. Sometimes by the information that's provided on those websites, you can even get a sense of the size of the companies, maybe because of the number of licenses or the number of technicians that they have at the company. There's a direct correlation between number of technicians and revenue size. And from there, you can start marketing yourselves. We've done everything. We've sent people Starbucks cards. We've sent them cans of popcorn to make sure that we are educating potential sellers out there or pest control owners that we exist and we would love to have a chance at talking to them about buying their business if and when they're ready or thinking about selling.
But when you buy their business, they don't leave. They stay, don't they stay?
It depends on what the owner wants, to be honest with you. We at Certus, we pride ourselves on trying to figure out what a potential seller is trying to achieve and what they care most about. Some sellers have reached the later part of their lives. They don't have a child or children to pass this asset down to, that this, you know, pass on the company they've built, maybe to one of their children or grandchildren. And so they're literally looking to exit the business, monetize what they've built so that they can go retire and travel and do whatever they want to go do. Younger, we run into younger sellers who maybe took the business up until the point to where they've kind of capped out. They've grown it to where they can get it, and they're looking to partner with somebody who might have capital or some skill sets or wherewithal to take it to the next level. And they really want to stick around. They're going to learn some stuff. You get the benefit of having continuity in the business. You partner together to go achieve whatever you both want to go achieve. So, and there's everything in between.
Yeah. So every single deal is unique. So who's the deal maker at your company?
I guess we have a BD team that lays the initial groundwork. We talk a lot about who the seller is. We gain insights. What do they care most about? Not only in the outcome post-close, but also deal structure. So we are very variable in meeting the needs of the seller in deal structure. Some just want to cash and be done. Some might want to roll some equity and participate in the bigger picture. Some might be interested in a seller's note because it's paid out over time. There's some tax benefit of doing that. And it kind of almost feels like a residual income stream. Plus, they're able to earn some interest on that. So structure-wise, we are really flexible finding out what the seller does. We do that through the BD team. I have a senior VP of strategy who oversees and leads M&A. He's a big part of deal structure and cutting the deal, but then also I'm fairly involved given my experience. And what we're really trying to do is figure out what the seller wants and structure a deal that's really interesting and meets the seller's needs.
So what you're sort of saying is that no two deals are the same.
No.
I mean, that isn't that kind of a nightmare for you guys internally? I mean, how do you manage that?
Well, look, they're different in the details. I say this all the time, no matter what it is, operationally, deals, numbers, data, the devil's in the details, right? But there's some commonality. I mean, we typically only do asset purchase deals versus doing a share deal. So asset structure, buying the assets of a business is pretty common in every deal we do. Always there's cash down, right? The owner wants to monetize and they want cash. They have a lot of their personal wealth maybe built up to this business and they're trying to diversify and take some chips off the table. But when you get into the finer points of rolling equity or, having a senior, you know, a seller's note and financing some of it, is there a holdback, related to maybe earnout or some of the indemnity type stuff? You know, there's enough commonality amongst every deal that it's not too cumbersome. Look, this team that I have at Certus, we've are approaching somewhere around 70 companies we bought since 2019. So we've done a lot, seen a lot. We have a lot of templates, a lot of negotiated language, having done 70 deals. And some of my team here were with me at a prior company where we did 102. So we're really, really comfortable, 102 acquisitions. So we're pretty comfortable. It's interesting and it's fun because every once in a while you come across something that you've never seen before, but we've seen most and have dealt with most. So we're pretty well versed at being able to slice the cake in a lot of different ways.
Do you have a target? Like how many companies, you know, what's the goal? Is it 100? Is it 200? You know, where do you guys say we've done enough?
Yeah, it's not a number. It's a, we look at it from a value creation standpoint. What is the return? You know, you always hear in private equity about the five-year itch, right? And that's the typical, and what people are referring to is what is the average hold time that a private equity initiates an investment, holds it, grows it, improves it, whatever the thesis is, to the time they monetize it to give their investors a return. It used to be 5 years was pretty common and pretty known and talked about. I've actually seen the hold times get a little longer. At the last company, it was 10 years. They started in 2010 and exited in 2020. Here at Certus, they started in 2019. I joined in 2021, and we're sitting here in 2025. But as much as every deal might be unique, every single PE firm is unique. And with our PE firm, we're still creating so much value and creating such a high accretive IRR to what we're building here, we're not even talking about what is enough or when we might be done. As long as we feel like we continue to build equity value and enterprise value at a fast enough pace so that it positively impacts the IRR and the return that we're creating on the investment, we're going to keep going.
So it seems like, you get a huge bang right up front where, you start reorganizing a company and the company starts being more productive because you straighten out a bunch of things that these people haven't done. But after a year or two, there's not much more straightening to do. So you kind of level out and you start diluting some of your long-term returns, don't you? I mean, by the longer you hold it, that's kind of why they want to keep it in a short time frame. Is the longer you hold it, you sort of start diluting some of your long-term returns. So how are you, what kinds of things are you doing with these companies to make them more valuable?
Well, Certus was a little bit unique, and there's definitely a life cycle of a buy and build strategy, right? So they kicked it off in 2019. And in the beginning years, you're just trying to gather assets, right? You're unknown in the industry. You're trying to build a name. You're trying to get these sellers comfortable to sell you their business, and you're going to be good stewards of their business. Treat their people the right way, grow it, right? And once you gather enough dots on the map, well, now you got to integrate it. So we kind of hit the pause button, put a hold on M&A for about 12 months while we integrated this thing into a cohesive single business. Because when I got here, it was 50 dots on a map. I call it a bowl of spaghetti. Right. I came in and I'm dealing with this bowl of spaghetti and I'm trying to create some kind of structure and organization around this bowl of spaghetti. You integrate everything, you synergize what you can synergize, you streamline and implement. But the key is that it's effectively 50 cultures that you've all brought together and you're trying to get it all into a cohesive single culture, so to speak. So that we all get on the same page, rowing the boat in the right direction, right? So we did that.
That's important to say is that these are not mergers. These are acquisitions. So, the person that you acquire doesn't get a lot of say in what the new culture is. I mean, Right. Somebody's got to be the boss. That boss is you. And you got to call the shots about how that is. So how do you integrate a bunch of companies from different parts of the country, different sizes, different bullheaded people, because every entrepreneur is a little bullheaded in their own way. How do you do that?
You integrate and you streamline and you organize what's easy to organize and streamline. Things like invoicing, accounts payable, billing, systems, HR and payroll systems.
You centralize those functions. So yep. you take all that overhead off their plate. So that's all right. They're doing is servicing accounts and you're doing the part that they probably don't like to do anyway. Or maybe that's it's right. The part that their spouse does or their kid does or somebody else. And you just take that inside and centralize
that's exactly
it.
Right. Right. Plan. A lot of these sellers that we interact with, they start to get the really successful ones. Start to get big enough to where those things like finance and accounting and tax and HR compliance and credit card processing and all that stuff starts to be big enough to where it's like, golly, that's not even what I enjoy doing. What I enjoy doing was servicing the customer.
That's what makes an entrepreneur want to go back and have a smaller business.
Right.
In a funny way, you can scale yourself right up into misery.
Right. That's exactly right. And we find that a lot because they reach the point to where it starts to almost become more of a burden and fun than it is fun. Right. Now, I actually consider that to be a high class problem. If you reach that point, you were really, really successful doing whatever you were doing to even get to the point of being frustrated by all that stuff. But that's why we come in and we like, okay, we got that in spades. We'll take that. We'll take it off your plate. You don't have to mess with it. We want you to focus on your people, your growth, your customers, because that's what you really enjoyed in the first place to begin with. And so that's one. Where you have to start being more careful is anything that impacts the employee or the customer. There, we'll go a little slower. We'll have a lot lighter hand. We might buy a business and they may be doing something in a different way or better than what we do. We may take what they're doing and want to roll it out to all of our other branches. We operate 23 branches in 10 states. Okay. If I go buy a business, I just bought a business in Sacramento. I wasn't in Sacramento, but I was south of Sacramento in the San Francisco Bay Area. This gives us a chance to move to Sacramento. Well, I'm not going to immediately integrate it or tuck it in. I want to learn what they're doing and how they're doing it. And they may be doing some things that are better than what I'm doing. And so I want to learn, because that's the other thing in home services. If there's 20,000 pest control companies in the United States, there's about 19,000 different ways to run a pest control company.
Yeah.
Which is part of the fun, right? But so you take a light hand on the things that impact the people, whether it's the customer or the employees, you streamline the things that are no brainers. And the other thing that I always say is I may be trying to create this Certus culture, but the reality is that since I have 23 branches out there, I have 23 micro cultures. And so the leader of those branches out there in the field are also managing and developing their own culture. And we try to be really careful not to stifle that and allow some uniqueness on a branch by branch location, especially given how broad our geographical landscape is.
You know, what seems to me to probably be the hardest thing, I mean, outsourcing accounting, that's easy, but what phone number do they call when they want to make an appointment, or if they need some help, or they have some animal or some bug or some problem that pops up, you know, in the afternoon one day and they need immediate service? Are you centralizing customer service, yep, or are you leaving that place by place?
Well, so far, every single question you've asked me, I could say and respond, well, there's a balance.
It depends.
That's going to be the theme. And I mean, look, we have branch office administrators in every single one of our branches, because there are some aspects of what happens in a branch that's unique to that branch. For example, we service gophers in Southern California. We service scorpions in Arizona. We don't do either one of those in Florida. So there are geographical pest pressures that are different across the 23 branches. So we have branch office administrators in each branch who may deal with some local customers, especially commercial businesses, maybe on some unique billing needs or the way they are invoiced and pay their bills. In general, we've centralized customer care. Customer care, it's hard when you do that because we operate multiple brands. So they're answering the phone and they need to know which one of those color of hats behind me, white, green, blue, black, who they are a customer of, right? But it also creates some amount of continuity and consistency across the platform and what the customer may expect or experience. But we've centralized it. I've seen other roll-up strategies where they're regionally based call centers, and other strategies where it's all done out of the individual branches. We have a mix.
What's the hardest part about rolling up a consumer-facing activity like this?
Communicating with the customer. It's amazing. You know, I read a study, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, that Terminix did. And basically what Terminix came to the conclusion was that 50% of the consumer wants to do, you know, buy local, use local with mom and pops and support local businesses. And the other 50% are looking for a well-known brand name like Terminix or Orkin. And we, you know, we try to maintain a balance. But what's interesting is if we buy a business and our trucks are red, but the business we bought, their trucks are white, if you're not really manic about educating the customer, handing it off, and all of a sudden that different color truck shows up in front of their yard, the consumer will cancel your service because you didn't handle the communications with the consumer the right way. So we take a long time before we tuck in an acquisition, before we rebrand it, before we do anything with it, to really make sure that the customer gets really used to, the employee and the customer both, really get used to what we do, how we do it. Even if we're replacing technicians because we're optimizing routes and you have one technician that's going to hand off the account to another technician, we'll do handoffs. The technician will introduce the other technician because some consumers are super sensitive to change. They like the consistency. You know, Joe, who's been my technician for 5 years, he knows my problems. I have a good relationship with him. He knows my property and house. And I don't want to do anything and make any change too abruptly that makes the consumer think, well, all of a sudden my service isn't going to be what I'm used to or what I expect. So it's that handholding and management of the customer that we spend a lot of time managing.
Can you share the revenue run rate? What's your revenue base? Can you say that?
Yeah, we're run rate. We're right at 96 right now.
96 million. So, and what's an average invoice, like a monthly invoice?
Oh, monthly, 40, 50 bucks.
So that's an enormous amount of invoices that are going out in the course of the year. I mean, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of invoices are going out to aggregate to that number of dollars.
Yeah, well, our customer base is well over 100,000. So we have well over 100,000 addresses and customers on the books. In regards to invoicing, so it is a lot of services, right? And we about a third of our business is monthly service, a third is bi-monthly, and a third is quarterly. So that's generally the breakdown. So you can tell, you know, and every single visit is an invoice. But we have a lot of people on an auto bill. They give us their credit card. We're about 60 to 65%. Now, the technician's still going. They're still getting a service report for the service that was completed, which is, you know, a quasi-invoice. The customer has the right to tell us, do they want it by text, email, or paper? We try to avoid paper. We try to get them on some kind of electronic delivery, and the system handles all of that. And if they're on auto bill with credit card on file, which more than 60% are, it really streamlines all the invoicing processes.
How's your technology? I mean, have you streamlined a lot of this because the techs have an iPad or one of those things, and they type in their stuff, and then it just wirelessly goes to your office? Are you organized that way?
Yeah, we have. To take it back to earlier, right, when I got here, we had a ton of different systems. People were using Field Routes, PassPack, ServiceTitan, BrioStack, GorillaDesk, like a lot of them, right? And that's one of the things we had to streamline and basically integrate is, and the key for us, I think one of our secrets to our success is transparency and insight into the performance of the business. But to be able to have that much transparency and insight into the major operating KPIs of the business, we had to get everybody onto a single platform. So that was part of that 1 year break of integration. We use a WorkWave product called PestPack, which is our main operating system, and all of our businesses operate in PestPack. And all of our technicians use a mobile device. So there's an app on the mobile device called Mobile 3.0, but that is the platform that they operate in where they're servicing the customer. working their way through their every single day. But yeah, everybody's on a single operating platform.
Yeah. And I just want to go back to one other thing, and then we'll start to wind down here. Why would a pest control operator want to go with you guys instead of doing something else, sell it to their neighbor, sell it to somebody else, and, you know, whatever the choices are that they have? Why would they go with you?
Well, besides purchase price, right?
Well, I don't know. Tell us about that.
I mean, look, I'll do the obvious one first, right? For people who are trying to monetize this asset that they built, they generally care about two things primarily. One is, well, what are you going to pay me for my business? And a lot of people want to maximize the purchase price. They want to maximize the amount of money that you're going to pay to them. On top of that, the structure of how you pay them, like I talked about earlier, whether it's an equity roll for a piece of it that gives them potential upside, a seller's note that gives them interest on some of that purchase price, or the cash. I mean, that's really important to a lot of people, right? The second one that a lot of people, particularly in pest control, care a lot about is, what are you going to do with their people? Do their people, you know, sometimes, a lot of times, our benefits, because a larger company, are better than the benefits that they were able to provide them. Maybe health insurance is better. Maybe the 401k, maybe we have a 401k. They didn't even have a 401k, you know, stuff like that. So how well are their people going to be taken care of? How are their people going to be paid? What are the, a lot of times a bigger company like us has greater growth potential for their people. I operate 23 branches across 10 states, and I'm growing really fast. A technician working for a mom and pop, especially if they're willing to move, has a greater chance at being promoted to an ops manager or branch manager. So upward mobility. At the end of the day, a lot of it has to do with feel. Culture is how that owner owned, operated, what they expect from their people. Does that align well with our culture, what we expect? How good of a fit is it? How different? Those are positives. If it starts to feel like very different, values are different, what they're trying to achieve is different, it might not be a good fit. But all of that kind of goes into why they might sell to us versus somebody else.
Listen, it's good. That probably gives people a lot to think about. So let me ask you one last question. When you're talking about Certus, your company, or the private equity outfit that sponsors you, or anything about your company, what would you say is your advantage play? What's the killer strategy that makes you guys awesome?
I think, first of all, I'll point to two things. First, people and culture. I mean, our people and our culture are a lot like me. What you see is what you get. Very genuine, very down to earth, direct, very honest. We'll tell you the good, the bad. We'll tell you what we're great at. We'll tell you what we struggle with. And I built a team of really, just really good, down to earth, competitive people who just want to be excellent at whatever they do. It doesn't matter whether it's HR, finance, operations, sales. I'm pretty manic about the culture that we maintain. And our success isn't me. Our success is our people and how they deal with and interact with other people. Which is with at a very genuine, transparent way, at a very high level of character and integrity. So I got to pay my team a lot of respect, because that's why we're as successful as we are. My background, the other thing I'll point to is, you know, my background is finance, data, numbers. I say it all the time. There's two sayings I say. In God we trust, all others bring data. The other one I say is sunshine is the best disinfectant. So I'm manic about making visible what are the major KPIs. They can be operational KPIs, they could be financial KPIs, but what are those that determine whether a business is successful or not? And I'm manic about making that visible and clear to everybody, setting targets on every single one of those, and letting people know where they stand against those targets and what does great look like. What is great? And then let's all strive and do the thing. I may not, you have the flexibility to determine the how, but I'm going to tell you what I think great is. We can even debate it. But then I'm going to try and get out of your way and let you drive to greatness. And it's that transparency. And it's everybody looking at the same data and the same numbers all the same way that get us rowing the boat in the same direction. And I think that's some of the stuff that makes us unique.
Yeah. Well, listen, that's certainly good leadership. You know, when you tell them, you tell the team where to go, and how they do it is up to them. I mean, that's good leadership. That reflects, well,
get out of their way so they can be successful.
Well, listen, and it reflects that you must trust them. They must be some decent people. I mean, you probably handpicked some good ones, and that goes a long way. So
yeah, it's definitely mutual trust. You know, you have to be, I think transparency, even down to the front lines. I mean, our frontline customer care technicians or salespeople, they want to trust whoever they're working for. They want to believe in wherever they're working. And the only way to do that is be super transparent. They want to know what success looks like. They want to know how they get paid. They want to know how they can earn more money. What do they have to do to earn more money and be successful? And as long as you make that really clear to them and you make it transparent so that they have visibility to their own success or failures, I think all tides rise.
Basically. Yeah. Well, listen, Dave Bradford, thank you for being on our show, and congratulations on your appointment at Certus to run that operation. I think they're lucky to have you. I mean, you've been a wonderful guest, and I hope you'll remain a friend of our show.
Yeah, 100%, Joel. I really appreciate you having me, and really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, very good. Well, listen, man, thank you very much, and we'll stay in touch.
You've been listening to Your Advantage Play with your host, Joel Block. To learn more about how to work with Joel and cultivate your own high-limit advantage plays, visit theadvantageplayer.com. Subscribe to Your Advantage Play wherever you get your podcasts.
How about a shout out and a huge thanks to our podcast show producer, David Wolf, and the team at Autovita Studios. Profit from the Inside wouldn't be possible without these wonderful professionals. To learn more or to find out how you can launch and produce your own podcast show, reach out to www.audivita.com. That's audivita.com.